드르데 초타네 요한데베 랍라부 디디 아 대한도
So there are about 550 students from different parts of India. And please raise your hands. Varanasi, those who have come from Varanasi, Tibetan University, Central Tibetan University, Tibetan Studies from Sarnath, please raise your hands. Delhi. 171 from Lady Shri Ram College in Delhi. Please raise your hands. 9 people from Lovely University in Punjab. Raise your hands. From St. John's Medical University in Bangalore. Raise your hands. Raise your hands. From Baroda. Ajmer. This one is asking if the Muslim Mullah in Ajmer is still alive. Very good practitioner. Islam. Vijayawada, Andhra Pradesh. There are three from Vijayawada, five from Pune. Engineering College from Ujjain. So in total there are 244 college-going students, Tibetan students who have come here. Ten from Tibetan Medical Ministry Institute. 20 from Sara Tibetan College. 7th time that His Holiness is giving this teaching or talks to the Tibetan students, younger generation. Greetings to everyone. Okay. So for 2 days we are going to have this discourse, and it is worthwhile for you to attend this discourse. You have not come here to listen to stories or for some entertainment or shows and so forth, but one of the most the oldest culture is what we are going to deal with. And for Tibetans, as for Tibetans, for thousands of years, our fourth bearers collected all this knowledge through great hardship and hard work. Of course, there are many ancient cultures in the world, but and also religious traditions. But in this 21st century, something which is relevant and which is needed and beneficial is this Tibetan Buddhist philosophy and concepts and our this culture related to it. So this is something which is relevant to and beneficial to today's world. So such a philosophical tradition is an authentic tradition. Whatever religion it may be, it has its own philosophical background, the views which develop over time as people's critical faculty grows. So today, through the science developments and progress in science and technology, we have lots of tools through which things are seen and discovered, which were not seen or discovered, but merely estimated in the past. So, but with regard to the inner science, inner world of mind, there is no new concepts about mind and so forth through these tools. So in ancient India, there has been lots of interest and lots of critical investigation into the nature of the mind. And for Jainism and Buddhism, which were more or less contemporary, developed in India. And with regard to Buddhism, Buddhism has taken all the positive concepts and ideas from the other religious traditions that were extant at that time. But then there is also the philosophical understanding which the Buddha found. And then the great masters of Nalanda, such as the 17 Nalanda masters, who investigated into the teaching of the Buddha and came up with all kinds of philosophical explanations and interpretations of the teaching of the Buddha. And these 17 masters were the main scholars who established the different philosophical systems. And on top of that, then we have the tantric practices explained by the Mahasiddhas of India, such as the teachings of Doha, the spontaneous spiritual songs by Mahasiddhas and so forth. And so this tradition of Nalanda institution spread into Tibet. So in Tibet, we had our own indigenous religion, the Bun religion, which spread in Xiangxiong area. It's, of course, we Tibetans have integrated certain elements from the Xiangxiong tradition as well. But on the whole, we have the culture which is profound and relevant and beneficial to today's world. So you study this profound culture tradition in your school curriculum, and so this is a treasure, our heritage and treasure. So we are preserving it, and this culture and philosophical tradition is what we are going to go through in these 2 days, 2-3 days. So during these 2 days, you should you would hear things that are new to you, and also things which you may have heard before but may not have understood. You will gain new understanding and insight, and so that things become clear. And also your misunderstandings or lack of knowledge about what you have studied before. I hope that you will gain new insights and be able to clear your misunderstandings. So here we are not only talking about gaining knowledge, accumulating knowledge, like other subjects, but here we are actually dealing with something which is beneficial, which is useful to throughout your life. So in this world where there's material development, where there's lots of material development and advancements, there are people who face lots of mental problems. And so this is because of the focusing only on material, on the development. And so when you are more or less more familiar with the modern subjects, which is oriented to, for material development, and that alone will not give you a real happiness and joy in your heart. Of course, there are lots of people who have really excellent knowledge and about modern subjects. But the things that you're going to hear in these 2 days would be really beneficial for your spiritual development. So let's say this prayer. Devori shekpa chik den kenpa kebo dewe kalo gyuwa la name va la dam minam ge tenpa san ge chum den de pe gyawa shekya tupa la cha tsa ho cha tupa. To the founder of the transcendent destroyer, Victor, and the one going beyond, the before destroyer, the complete, the perfect, the fully awakened being, perfect in knowledge and good conduct, Sugata, knower of the world, supreme guide of human beings, to be tamed, teacher of gods and humans, to you, the complete and fully awakened one, the Bhagavan, the glorious conqueror, the subduer from the Shakya clan, I prostrate my offerings and go for refuge. when, O Supreme Human Jiva born on this earth, you paced out seven strides and then said, I am supreme in this world. To you who will rise, then I prostrate with you. Pure bodies, pure form supremely pure wisdom ocean, like a golden mountain, fame that blazes in the three worlds, winner of the best law. To you I prostrate with the supreme science, face like spotless moon, color like gold. To you I prostrate, dust free like you. The three worlds are not incomparable, wise one. To you I prostrate, the savior having compassion, the founder having all understanding, the filled of merit with qualities like a vast ocean. To you, the one going to distance, I prostrate, the purify, the purity that frees one from attachment, the virtue that frees one from lower realms, then one path that supplies pure reality to the Dharma that pacifies, I prostrate. Those who are liberated and who show the path to preparation to the holy field, qualified realizations, who are devoted, devoted to the moral precepts, to you, the sublime community, intending which I prostrate. Do not come in on virtuous actions performed in virtuous actions. So, this is teaching of the Buddha in the Jiju, but with this in La Chod. Gade gade para sangha de bodhi soha. Deata gade para sangha de bodhi. Deata gade para sangha de bodhi soha. This is a verse of salutation from Abhisamaya Alamkara by Maitreya. Dadem be tum nam nam ba kun de na so ti sum ba nyen de chan ju sim be so che san ge gen yum de ma cha. This is a verse of salutation from Nagarjuna's Mula Pranjanam Mula Madhyamaka Karika, which says, I prostrate. It's a homage to the Buddha, the best teacher for teaching dependent rising, free from the eight extremes. So the students were able to recite these prayers. So I wrote this text. The opening the mind. I wrote in the '60s, very early on. It was written in 1963, as the colophon says in the Tibetan. So it's been 50 years since I wrote this text. A long time. So perhaps I'll read through the text and then give some comments and explanations here and there. So since all of you have the text. To this is a homage to the ultimate pristine awareness or wisdom, which thoroughly distinguishes the true nature of things. So, of course, prostrations or homage can be made to the Buddha or Manjushri and bodhisattvas like Manjushri and Avalokiteshvara and so forth. So for people, especially the students, so this was written for students who are young, and are engaged in their studies of different subjects. And so for you, what is important is this critical faculty, investigating into the nature of things, and the wisdom or intelligence. As Manjushri, there is praise of Manjushri, where it says, the one who dispels the darkness of the three worlds. And so here, the darkness is the within, darkness within ourselves, which is the ignorance. So this must be dispelled through the development of wisdom. So it's wisdom, it's the most important factor. So the ultimate wisdom, which distinguishes or understands this ultimate nature, is so the Buddhas and the Manjushri and so forth have reached this state of total awareness or the culmination of wisdom, realizing the true nature of things. Reading through the text, at this point in the 5,000-year span of teaching of the fourth Buddha of this era, we are approaching the time when the only practice of Dharma remaining will observance of ethics. And so it was written, I wrote this text, 1563, and the situation today is still the same. I've known over these 50 years so many people, and because of lack of development within the mind, we are still facing lots of problems. Of course, many people put their hope in the material development and wealth, but as thinking that if they have material development and money and wealth, then these would do away with all their problems. But money and wealth will not and will help to overcome physical discomfort, but money they will not overcome the mental problems. So in the 20th century, an era of nuclear weapons, tremendous progress has been made externally in the material sciences, while internally there remains a very great need for corresponding development of the mind. According to Buddhist philosophy, that is achieved through contemplation and meditations. We need to understand how to practice them. And so in our traditional subjects, we have the five major subjects or sciences, and of these five, Buddhism is the main subject. And in our Buddhist tradition, of the Nalanda tradition, the teaching of the Buddha is understood or established through the logic and epistemology. So with regard to Buddhism, the Buddha himself has said, O monks and scholars, just as the gold is tested by burning, cutting, and rubbing, likewise you should investigate thoroughly into my teaching and gain faith, but not out of your devotion to me. And so Buddhism, of course, the teachings of the Buddha were translated into other languages like China and so Japan and so forth. And so the Buddha has said that you should not believe him just because he is your teacher, but you should actually investigate and examine his teaching. And through your investigation and examination, when you find the teachings to be corroborating to standing to the test of reason, and then if they also corroborate with your experience when you apply the teachings within yourself, then you should accept them. And so the Buddha had such confidence in himself to say that his disciples should examine his teaching. So I do not disrespect all the other religious traditions of the world. I, in fact, indeed respect all of them. But most of the religious traditions tell us to believe in, tell the followers to believe in what the founder teachers have taught them, and not they're not asked to do investigation and examination of the teachings, but the Buddha has actually said something contrary to that, in fact, to examine his teachings. And therefore, masters like Nagarjuna and so forth have made distinction between what the teachings that are that can be taken literally or not. And so when they found certain teachings not to be taken literally, they if these teachings which were given to certain disciples due to their mental predispositions, interest and proclivity and so forth, if we take them literally, then they would be there would be lots of internal contradictions through reasoning. And therefore, Master Nagarjuna and so forth have said that such teachings cannot be taken literally. And so generally in Buddhism, and particularly the Nalanda tradition, is very profound in this sense of doing investigation into the teaching of the Buddha. And so demonstrating the teaching of the Buddha through reason is and logic is something very unique to the Nalanda tradition. Of course, in the Pali tradition, which has spread to Sri Lanka, Burma, Thailand, and so forth, of course, the teachings are marvelous. I have been to Thailand in the past, but have not been able to go since then. So I've met many monks and scholars from these Theravada countries, and very admirable. But they do not have the study of Madhyamaka and epistemological texts, whereas the Sanskrit tradition, which has spread to China and through there, from there to Korea, Japan, and Vietnam, they do have the texts on Madhyamaka philosophy, but with regard to the text on logic and epistemology, they do not have many of them. But in Tibet, the epistemology texts on logic and epistemology have actually spread with the help of Master Chandrakshita, who came to Tibet in the 8th century, and also his main disciple, principal disciple, Kamalashila, also who came to Tibet. So because of them, the students, Tibetans, who followed their tradition, studied Buddhism through logic and epistemology, real logic and reason. Which was started by the Master Chandrakshita and Kamalashila in Tibet. And so, in this, book, I shall explain the principle name in few plain words and share illuminating wisdom, which reveals the and the fortune with the fortunate people who otherwise lacked opportunity to study profound, extensive teachings of the great treatises. All wandering beings equally desire happiness and do not want suffering, which is so not only for us intelligent humans, but also for the naive and closed-minded, even down to the tiniest worms and insects. All desire happiness and the wish not to experience even the slightest suffering. Therefore, both yourself and others must engage in the means which give rise to happiness and not bring about suffering. For if we hope and just expect to have happiness and thinking, may I have not may I not have suffering, we will be unable to either to find happiness or dispel suffering. Therefore, we require an ability to implement the causes for which happiness and from which happiness arises, and limit the basis that which gives rise to suffering. Whatever we may do, there is no more perfect and complete means of establishing cause, benefit, and happiness, and the elimination of suffering and harm than practicing the Dharma. So as I've written here, animals down to the tiniest insects do not want suffering but want happiness. This is very clear if we really pay a closely look at them. So in today's world, there is this trend where the animals are not really seen as being sentient. And even if they see them to have some feeling or sensation, people are disregard the suffering inflicted on them. In the past, when I used to go down from Dharamsala to Pathankot, on the roadsides there didn't used to be many stalls where chickens are sold. But later, even small tea stalls or small restaurants have throughout the year chickens in cages and on the roadsides. Many of them have been established, and as a matter of time, these chickens will die at the hands of the owners. So, and then there is also the piggery, fishery, and poultry farm everywhere in the world today. So people do not consider them to these animals to have any feeling and sensation. So this is they only consider them to be food for humans. So it's very sad. So of course, as Tibetans traditionally, for example, all Tibetans cannot be vegetarian, but the nomads in Tibet didn't have any other provisions like vegetables and so forth. But even the nomads who actually had to rely on animals for meat, when they actually have to kill an animal for meal for the family, what the families would actually recite the Om Mani Padme Hum mantra, realizing that they are doing something wrong, killing an animal. But within that recognition, they actually recite. With that recognition, they also recite the mantra. So they were considerate to the animal's life. And so people have now done so much fishing that the number of fish is now dwindling, people say these days. So these happen, these mass killings of animals happen because of not being considerate to the life of animals, that they have also suffering, and not considering that they want happiness and not suffering. So with regard to the brain, of course, we have the animals also have brains, and brain in itself has not much work for thinking. And to a certain degree, animals also use their brain, and then also we humans use brain. But mainly our happiness and pleasure, pain and pleasure come through our thinking. using our minds. And so with regard to using the mind and giving creating pain and pleasure, the animals have less thinking. Where the animals, when they are out of danger to their life, then and they have their fill, then they don't worry, they relax. Whereas we humans, although we may have a good family, wealth, money, and so forth, but because of this lots of thinking, thought processes that go on in our minds, and people are not, and people are, when people are not able to use their mind well, then they resort to drugs and sleeping pills and so forth to overcome the disturbed state of mind. So if your mind is disciplined, then you do not have to take to alcohol or drugs. And so for us humans, it is not enough only to have the physical comfort, all the facilities for physical comfort, but so animals and humans have the same kind of physical comfort. In terms of physical comfort, this is something common to both animals and humans, but we and humans, when we have peace of mind, then the physical discomfort can be overcome, overshadowed. Whereas if your mind is not peaceful, if you have no peace of mind, then your physical pain will overcome your. And amongst these children also in your homes, you will find differences amongst these children. Those who are peaceful and are happier. And so for humans, the physical pain and pleasure is not so powerful, but the mind, the mental pain and pleasure are more powerful. So, of course, physical pain and pleasure is important for us, but compared to the mind, it's not so important. So, relying on the Dharma will be able to generate happiness and eliminate suffering in this life, the next life, and many future lifetimes. So, all the Christians or Muslim practitioners or other religious practitioners, and also in Buddhism, there is mention of vehicles of gods and humans. And so, most of the religious traditions of the world come under this category of the vehicles of gods and humans, where there is the emphasis on practice of love and compassion. So all the major religious traditions teach love and compassion. And in order to all these religious traditions also recognize that there is also obstacles to the cultivation of love and compassion, and such as this not being contented, and which actually disturbs or goes against the practice of love and compassion. And therefore, there is teaching of tolerance, to safeguard love, practice love and compassion, and also the practice of forgiveness is there in all religious traditions. And then, because of greed, there is lots of problems happen, and therefore there's the practice of, against this, there's the practice of contentment in these religious traditions, such as Christianity. So the Christian monks live a very simple life with little wants. And then there is also the practice of self-discipline, keeping morality, and so from human experience itself, we know that peace of mind comes through love and compassion, and therefore this is what all these religious traditions teach. And now, in order to promote and advance this practice of love and compassion, we have the theistic religions, where there is belief in a creator God, which is permanent, and so this God, the creator, is seen as being of infinite love. So this is the nature of God, according to the theistic religions. This is a very powerful belief. So when the theistic followers of theistic religions say that they are created by this kind of God, who is all-merciful, or of infinite love, because you are creation of such a God of love, and therefore, as in Buddhism, we say every sentient being has what is known as Buddha nature. They also believe that as creation of God, we also have some part of that nature of love. So according to these theistic traditions, we have this potential for love. And therefore, what God has taught us is the practice of love and compassion. And then, when you are taught, when the practitioners of theistic religions actually submit themselves to God, believing that they are a creation of that God, they actually are able to reduce their extreme self-centered attitude. And then there is also the teachings in these theistic religions about after death, going to heaven or hell, according to whether you have done the good things or bad. And then there is also the vehicle of Brahma mentioned in Buddhist text. So, for example, the non-Buddhist traditions like Hinduism and so forth, they have the practice of single-pointed concentration, shamatha or samadhi, and I'm trying to find people who actually are deeply involved and engaged in samadhi and meditation, although I've not been able to find them yet. And then there are the sadhus, Indian Hindu sadhus who live in the Himalayas, high up in the Himalayas, sometimes even naked, without much clothes, and even staying naked. They practice what is known as inner mystic heat or psychic heat, and Baba Ramdev. And so there is this famous Indian yogi, or Baba Ramdev, who teaches these physical exercises of yoga practice. And we also, in our text, also there are these different yogas, physical yogas. In the past, I have heard that in Gorakhpur area, there were non-Buddhist practitioners who do the practice of transference of consciousness, and also
projecting the mind out of the body and transferring it to another body and so forth. And so such practices, as will come in this text later, even the non-Buddhists have the practice of single-pointed concentration. And in Buddhist texts, we differentiate between worldly and transcendental insight, where the plane of existence where you belong and is seen as very the experiences are seen as very being very rough, and the higher planes of existence, the concentrations are seen as being of more subtle experiences and more peaceful, and therefore you aspire to reach the higher concentrations of the higher realms of existence. And so these come within the practice of the worldly insight practice. And so these practices come under the category of the vehicles of Brahma. So I've also heard that amongst the Christian practitioners, there are people who do single-pointed concentration. So the same passages that were read earlier, and then taking this life as an instance, there is nothing superior to Dharma in producing happiness and limited suffering. For example, there is great difference between one who has understood the Dharma and one who has not, with reference to the degree of the mental and physical suffering and the ability to cope with them. If the importance of the Dharma is not understood and the benefits of teaching are not integrated with the mind, when there is strong feeling of sickness in the body, the mind cannot bear it. Both body and mind are oppressed by great suffering, and the agony of pain affords to no opportunity to experience happiness. If the importance of Dharma is understood, when the body experiences sickness by seeing it as the result of previously accumulated wrongdoing, as being the nature of cycling existence, and through the wishing that through wishing to take the responsibility for the action by accepting the sickness, mental suffering will not be experienced. Consequently, some physical pain may be overcome by the inner power of mind through which suffering will be dispelled. For that reason, mind is the principal factor controlling the body, while the body is something to be controlled. Thus, the mind's feelings of happiness or pain are the more powerful of the two. Correspondingly, some people who wish to become rich through hoarding and guarding wealth arrive initially both mental and strive initially both mentally and physically, but experience the frustration of being unable to gather as much as they wish. In the process, they experience the frustration of being robbed, losing their wealth, and or wasting it and being unable to protect. And finally, whatever they do, they must experience the suffering of being forever separated from their wealth, which passes into the possession of others. All these suffering related wealth and possessions are faults arising from not understanding the real meaning of spirituality. If they understand the teaching and see all riches as essence, like a dew drop on a blade of grass, will not experience the frustration stemming from countless attempts to hoard and guard our wealth from being unwittingly separated from it. Similarly, when others insult, rebuke, and speak unpleasant words to us, although an intolerable pain arises like thorn at the heart, if we comprehend the teachings, we can recognize these essences of nature, which resembles an ego. So just as when an inanimate object is scalded, we'll experience not the slightest mental turmoil. Likewise, we suffer in this life from being unable to support our family and friends, or we suffer personal defeat while others are successful, and so on. In brief, whatever physical or mental pain we have, such as gain and loss or happiness and misery, it is dependent upon wishes and anxiety. Similarly, fighting between nations creates destructions and fear and shatters innumerable people's happiness, of which only the name remains, while fomenting sufferings like a stormy sea. In short, any major or minor suffering experienced in this life falls upon either not understanding the Dharma or being unaware of it, but not putting it into being aware of it, but not putting it into practice. If we practice the teachings, we know we will be able to stand stem the flow of all this suffering. One might ask, how this is possible? All such suffering, all solely because of pride, miserliness, jealousy, and three delusions, aversion, and so forth. Those faults mind are pacified as well, mainly due to powerful dharma and contentment, a sense of shame, consideration, conscientiousness. So even if you are thinking of this life alone, you should mainly focus on gaining peace of mind. So even if you may not have any belief in religion, the principles taught in the teachings in the religions, such as contentment, love, compassion, contentment, tolerance, and so forth, are still very useful and helpful to you. So over the last many years, I have had discussions with scientists, and from these, what I can sum up is that amongst the 7 billion, from amongst the 7 billion people in this on this earth, slightly more than 1 billion people So from amongst these 7 billion human beings on this earth, so 1,000 million is 1 billion. So in Tibetan literature, we find 60 digits that we can count from 0 to. So all these are the different numbers that we have, although we may not have the money to count up to the into these numbers. So the population of human population of this world is 7 billion, and it is popularly said that over 1 billion of these 7 billion people are non-believers. A few months ago, I read in a newspaper report that the over 1 billion people profess themselves to be non-believers, so which is a big number, actually. So 1/7 of the human population is a huge number, and secondly, they are all humans who do not want suffering but want happiness. So even amongst the religious people, those who profess to be religious do not pay much attention to the practice of love and compassion and so forth. But and then the non-believers say that they do not believe in religion, and therefore they even neglect these principles of love and compassion. And so whether you are a believer or non-believer, love and compassion and moral principles are necessary if you wish to live a happy life. And so therefore, it is very important for you to recognize this. And therefore, these days I've been talking about the importance of secular ethics without touching any religion. But secularism doesn't mean anti-religion or anything like that, but this secular ethics is the foundation of all the religious traditions. So secular ethics mainly talks about the practice of love and compassion. So as humans, we were born, all of us, come from our mothers, and therefore we have experienced tremendous love and care from our mother. So right after birth, for several years, without the mother's care and love, we could not have survived. And therefore, love and compassion are actually have absorbed in our blood. And so, the more love and compassion there is, and then in a family, there is greater peace. And even if you may be billionaires, without love and compassion in the family will not be, you won't have a happy family. So I usually tell people that if for billionaires, when they are sad, if they kiss the $1 million, the diamond ring will not give any condolence or console you. Whereas if you have a pet, cat or dog, if you take care of them when you are unhappy, when you actually take care of them, then you will actually be helped by them. The cats and dogs will lick it on your cheek. And the if the pets are very bright and alert, then are very clever, and they, when the master comes back from work with a very gloomy mood, face, then the dogs and cats will actually come to you and console you. Whereas if the master, on the other hand, is not so nice to the pets, then the pets will also run away from them when they come home. And so these animals can also show love and love and compassion. So the love and compassion is something innate in us. So within this, there is a love and compassion which comes from, based on our biological factor. Because of the very body and biological factor that we have this the natural tendency to show love and compassion to others. And secondly, as humans, we live in social animals. We belong to social animal, and even a honey bee lives in community, and therefore, a single bee cannot survive by itself because they must live in community. And so they do not have any religion, education or religion, or they do not have any law or police, but they work together to gather the honey from the essence from the flowers. So each and every one of these community of bees actually work together. So this is something biological. So we also, as humans, also have this biological love and compassion biologically. So in our childhood, when others have shown us love and compassion, then we also have become able to have this tendency to love others. But as we grow up, when we reach the ages of 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10, and so forth, then we tend to lose the tendency to show love to others. And then, as we grow up further, we actually become, they become rather dormant, and especially because of the educational system that we are in, which is more oriented towards material developments, and therefore neglect and we forget love and compassion. So as humans living in human community, We had actually this love, the experience of love and compassion were quite fresh, whereas they become dormant as we grow up. And because of the education system and the education itself, which is focused on a more material development, and then there's a sense of competition, and therefore you have jealousy, and then mistrust amongst ourselves. So whereas love and compassion actually gel us together, love and hatred and anger, jealousy and so forth will actually disperse us. So which is against our nature, the jealousy, competitive feeling and so forth, and anger. And then you actually become angry, and in the worst case scenario, you commit suicide. So therefore, the secular ethics is the foundation of all the is something which is biological, and is the foundation of all the religious traditions. And with regard to religion, it is only extend. I mean, there in the human society, and the previous Pope, Pope Benedict the 16th, has said that we need to reason and faith to go together. So he's a very intelligent pope. He was an intelligent man. He's an intelligent man. And so religion is something which exists only in human society, because we as humans have this intelligence. And by using our intelligence, we can actually come to draw conclusions, such as saying that there is, and through reason, we can establish or say that there is God, the creator, and say that everything that we have comes from God. So as humans, we need both religion and religious faith, and faith and reason. They must go together. So in we are thinking about introducing the secular ethics in a secular field of knowledge. So we are working towards this. Perhaps we may come out with the curriculum in this year or the next year. So to practice in such a way to gain predominant the happiness of this life is inadequate, because however great happiness of this life, it is happiness that lasts only until death. However long life may be, not last more than 100 years, and just so long will that happiness endure. Since the trail of future life is long and hazardous, we need to give it some direction. Thus, we should strive towards means for finding happiness and eliminating suffering from the stream of future lives. That too can be only done only that can be done only in conformity with the Dharma, never in accordance with the other activities. So, Dharma here mainly refers. I refer to Buddhism. So, Dharma means to protect or to. To hold you from suffering and its causes. So even in Christianity, we can apply this connotation or the meaning of Dharma, which is to say that through the practice of Christianity, the practitioners would create causes which would actually protect them or save them from lower realms of existence and lead them to a paradise or heaven. then even in the non-Buddhist traditions, classical non-Buddhist traditions of India, there are practices for leading into the higher realms of existence. And whereas according to Buddhism, we say that because they still hold on to the view of Atma or soul, there's no ultimate liberation or nirvana for them as such through the own path. So those who have not come here before, please raise your hands. So I have explained this before. One time I was in Amritsar and attending an interfaith conference, and one of the organizing organizers was one Sikh organization in Canada, and so this conference was held in Amritsar. And at the conference, there was a Sufi scholar who said that all brought up these three questions. First is, what is self? And then, and whether this self has any beginning, when did it originate? And then itself, whether the self has an end or not. So he said that all the religious traditions try to answer these three questions, try to find answer to these three questions. So this is a big comprehensive sort of idea. So with regard to this first question, what is self? The Buddha has said this notion of an I or self is a devilish mind. And I will see it. And he says that all these psychophysical aggregates are empty, and therefore there is no self. And so in Buddhism, there's teaching of these four seals of Dharma, which says that all composite phenomena are impermanent, and all impure and contaminated things are in the nature of suffering, and there is no self, and nirvana is peace. So except Buddhism, all the rest of the philosophical or religious traditions do assert a self. The theory of self, belief in self or Atma is there in all the religious traditions except Buddhism. The soul is seen as something which governs the body and mind, and the body and mind are its subjects. And therefore, with regard to this first question, there are two different answers. Answer according to Buddhism, which says there is no such a self, independent self, whereas the other religious traditions do assert soul or Atma. Now, with regard to the second question, whether there is a beginning to the self or not, for the theistic religions, for example, Christianity, this very life was created by God, and there is no past life as such. So this very life is creation of God. And therefore, the moment this self was created by God, that was the beginning of the self, and therefore there is a beginning to it. Now, with the, in the non-Buddhist Indian classical texts, literature, there are two different views. Those who believe in a permanent, single, and autonomous self or Atma, and there are others who do not believe in this. And then there is also belief in karma. And so in the beginning, the belief that the self or Atma was created by Brahma, whereas later on, then this Atma is going on from lifetime to lifetime. So there is a beginning to the self in the initial state, whereas the non-theistic Sankhya school and Jainism and Buddhism say that there is no beginning to the self. Mathura. So I was in Mathura, nearby Agra. Visited an ashram, a Hindu ashram, and the Swamiji was... this Swamiji there is a very knowledgeable person, and he knew Sanskrit, and he also was familiar with the texts by Nagarjuna, Master Nagarjuna. And so I had the opportunity to discuss about with him. And in my discussion, I asked him whether the non-theistic Sankhya school believed in a self, a beginning, believed that there is a beginning to self or not. And so this school of thought, the non-theistic Sankhya school, has this belief that there is a conscious self which actually enjoys or uses the various manifestations of the primal factor. And so from the discussion with the Swamiji in Mathura, I actually found out that this self does not have a beginning. And so Jainism, non-theistic Sankhya school, and Buddhism do not believe and say that there is no beginning to itself. So, in according to Christianity, for example, they said after death, then people would go to heaven, and after reaching heaven, whether there is an end or not, it's not very clear. So in Italy, one time I had a discussion with a Christian brother, and I asked him, "What happens after reaching heaven? What happens to the soul?" And he told me that there is no such discussions in our literature. And so, the non-theistic the Sankhya school and Jainism and Buddhism do not assert that they assert that there's no end to the self as well. And so, according to Buddhism, a person or a being is designated on the basis of five psychophysical aggregates. And when you are in a formless realm, of course, there is no physical aggregate as such. But so a being is someone who is designated on the basis of either four or five psychophysical aggregates. So with regard to this physical aggregate, there is a beginning for example, to this. So when we talk about someone coming from the past life into this life and from going from this to the next life, we have to explain it on the basis of the other four aggregates, not the physical aggregate. So because these are related to consciousness, the continuum or continuity of consciousness, so the main, the principal basis for the designation of a person or a being is the continuity of the consciousness, in relation to which we have the other aggregates like feeling or sensation, compositional factor, and intention and so forth, and therefore whether there is a beginning to self a person or not, we have to check whether this continuity of the mind has a beginning or not. So it's very clear to us that this consciousness or the mind that we have changes from moment to moment. There's a momentary change. As years go by in schools, children, we can say that their knowledge also grows as years go by in their school. And so it's very clear that there is a change going on in the mind. And why does this change happen? Because the nature of mind is impermanent or momentary. Therefore, with regard to the course of the mind, there are the primary cause or substantial cause and then the cooperating factor. And so with regard to the substantial cause or the primary cause of mind, you cannot have something which is not a mind that serves as a substantial cause of the mind, because the very nature of the mind itself is knowing and clarity or luminosity, and therefore this cannot come from matter. And so matter cannot be a substantial cause of mind or consciousness. And so because the mind itself has no beginning, the continuity of the mind has no beginning in itself, therefore there is no beginning to the self or the person also. And then whether there's an end to the mind or not, some philosophical schools within the Buddhism assert that there is an end after reaching our heart shape, when one has already overcome all the delusions from one's mind, and then when you die from this life, nothing is left of them. But then the other philosophical schools within Buddhism actually reject such a view and object to it. So when it is explained that the goals of future lives must be accomplished, there are some who do not understand the Dharma, or who know a little but do not grasp the reasoning perfectly, who may think that the present mind depends simply on this body, and that since past and future lives cannot be seen directly, they do not exist. Such an opinion either maintains that if something exists, it must be seen directly, or that the mind is produced independent on the body, and that since the body is formed independent on the four elements, previous lives do not exist. It is thought that at the time of death, the body reverts to the four principal elements, while the mind vanishes like a rainbow in the sky, and that therefore future lives do not exist. Others, asserting that the mind is dependent on the body, consider that the ability to intoxicate is an attribute of alcohol, or so the mind is the attribute of the body. Others think that like the brightness of lamp, the mind is a product of the body, and that, or that like a drawing on a wall, the mind is a decoration of the body. Essentially, all these views assert that in this life it is not necessary for the mind, which is produced at the time of birth, to be generated from the corresponding mind, because it is born from inanimate elements. By way of example, it is likewise thought that intoxication resulting from drinking alcohol and fire produced with magnifying glass, etc., results which arise from incongruent causes. Similarly, some dialecticians assert the non-existence of causality based on correct reasoning, stating that there is no agent creating the roundness of peas, the sharpness of thorns, nor the splendor of peacock's tails. While it may be observed that the mice who never give become rich, that killers live long, and so forth. Moreover, others claim that some meditators absorbed in concentration have seen through clairvoyance that those who were miserly in former lives were subsequently born into rich families. For this reason, they assert that although past and future lives exist, the principle of causality does not exist. Yet others, when they've achieved the concentration or formless realm through meditative concentration and absorption through the meditative concentration, mistake it for liberation when they fall away from it and see that they must again take rebirth. They conclude that liberation does not exist. So there is a view that there is no mind separate from the brain, that what mind is the brain, whereas in modern science there were people who held such view, but today some scientists who are unbiased, who are very impartial, say that of course the grosser layers of mind are dependent on our physical faculties like brain and so forth, but then when it comes to subtle minds, they say that a thought process can actually trigger brain movement and then there's also people who go through training of mindfulness, and therefore through these training they find that our thought processes and meditation can actually impact our brain, and therefore there is some tendency to assert that such mind or consciousness, which is a mere experience, is there apart from the brain, because they find that there's less inconsistency in asserting such thing. Nevertheless, despite these various assertions, past and future life certainly exists for the following reasons. Certain ways of thinking from last year and the last year before it, even from childhood, can be recollected. Now, this clearly establishes that there is awareness previous to a present continuity of awareness and of an adult. Likewise, the first instance of consciousness, if this life is not produced without cause, nor is it born from something permanent, neither is it produced from a solid, inanimate, incongruent, substantial cause. Therefore, it must surely be produced from a congruent, substantial cause. In what way are they congruent? Since a moment of mind is an awareness which is clear and knowing, it is preceded by a similar moment of mind which was clear and knowing. It is not feasible that such a preceding awareness be produced other than on the basis of the previous birth. Otherwise, the physical body alone were the substantial cause. If the physical body alone were the substantial cause of mind, then the absurd consequence of dead body having a mind and change, and a change in the body necessitating a change in consciousness, would also ensue. The substantial cause of mind is that which is susceptible to be transformed into the nature of mind. Although the physical body may act as an auxiliary cause of subtle change in mind, it is impossible for it to be a substantial cause. Something inanimate can never transform into mind, nor can mind transform into something inanimate. Although some may assert such transformations, justifying them with a few examples of changes in external change, which is the way in which the non-physical mind changes and the way physical objects change are different. Illustration, it is impossible for what is not space to become transformed into space, nor for space itself to change into that whose nature is not space, and changes in non-physical mind are similar. Thus, with reference to the present physical body and non-physical mind, the essential cause of the body is the blood and semen produced by the parents. But the parents' minds can never be substantial cause of the present moment. For example, it is possible for an adult, for a dull and foolish child to be born and to intelligent parents, no matter how educated they are. From this, it can be seen that there is no part of parents' bodies or minds which transform into their child's mind in this life. Therefore, in reality, mind flowing from the previous life acts as the substantial cause of this mind, and the blood and semen of our present parents act as the substantial cause of this body. As a relationship between the two was established by an action in the former lives, a relationship exists between the body and mind of this life. Due to that, even a newborn baby or calf immediately after birth begin to eat or suck at the mother's breast without being taught. This is the indication, an indication of instincts left in the minds from previous lives. So perhaps we may not limit this instinct from the past life, because Bhav Viveka has said we may have taken birth as earthworms in the past life. Amongst you school children, there may be many who were born as earthworms. So we may have been born as earthworms for 10 or 20 lifetimes, but that doesn't mean that in this life we also feed on earth, the soil. And then we were also, in the past, we have taken birth as carnivorous animals, like tiger and leopards. So you may, in one life, you were born as tiger, feeding on other animals and flesh, whereas when you were born as a herbivorous animal in the next life, I mean, that doesn't mean that you would be feeding on flesh in that life. And then, if you are born as cats, then you will not feed on grass, except when the cat is suffering from some bile imbalance. Then they actually take some grass. So there may be some things which may be explained only on the biological on the basis of the body. So, for example, if we have some imbalance of a bile, then if you get some food which is actually going to be bad for flaring up the bile, physically, biologically, you will react to that such food. And so there are different expressions that come out biologically. So with regard to the imprints that are left on the mind, according to Prasangika school, even after where it is said that even after the karma itself has stopped being, and the active karma has stopped, there is still what is known as the disintegration of the karma, and because of that disintegration, that leaves its imprint on the mind, then we would suffer the consequences of the karma in the future. So it continues until it gives rise to the fruit. It is also unreasonable to think that past and future life do not exist because they are not seen directly. For it is unacceptable to assert the non-existence of something merely because we have not seen it ourselves. We can understand this in the stage, in this age of science and technology, from our experience of seeing and hearing of many new external and internal discoveries, of which our forefathers in centuries past were unaware. Moreover, there are many who have seen past and future lives upon reaching a high level of concentration during intense meditation in reliance upon the Dharma. There are also many people who, because of various instincts, recollect the events from their past former lives. So after writing this book, then I met one girl in Patiala who was able to remember her past life very clearly, and also in Kanpur there was a girl who did had a similar clear memory of her past life. And so even amongst Tibetans there are people, children, who do have such memory. And so as we grow up we tend to forget the past memory of the past lives as the experiences of this life take override them. But then if you are able to cultivate single-pointed concentration, then I know some of my friends who are able to remember their past lives through the power of their meditation, concentration. And the mind being separate from the body, independent of the body, is very clear through the phenomenon called Thugdam, where people stay it's kind of a meditation even after clinical death. And so there are scientists who do research on such this phenomenon. So after the brain the brain stops getting blood from the heart, then within a few minutes there's brain dead. And even after brain dead, there are people in the last 50 years who stayed in this Thugdam for about 18 days a few years ago in New Zealand. There was a Tibetan Lama who stayed in this Thugdam for 17 days, and my senior tutor, the late senior tutor, Yongzhen Ling Rinpoche, also stayed in Thugdam for 13 days, and then a former 100th Garden Tripa, throne holder of the Garden tradition, stayed in meditation for about 21 days. And so we used the electrodes to check the ECG or something like that, and there was some movement after 6, 7, or 8 days after his clinical death. There was some electrical movement that happened in his body. And so this is something the scientists who actually checked this data said that this is something which is unprecedented. There's no explanation from science so far. And so the gross levels of mind, of course, are dependent on our brain and physical faculties, but the subtle ones are not dependent on them. And so memory from the past lives can be explained on the basis of the subtle mind. So it cannot be explained on the basis of the body, because this body is new to the consciousness. And there are accounts of how long the Buddhist scholar debated with Dhanista and to prove the existence of past and future lives. What? There are accounts of how long ago in India, Buddhist cults debated with hedonist Charvakasa, and to prove the existence of past and future births directly to him, took the king and others as his witness, died and reborn, later to become Acharya Chandragami. Also in Tibet, there were many who remembered their past previous lives and who recognizing people and objects from those times gave accounts of them. Therefore, as future birth certainly exists for us, we must establish a definite purpose for it now. The way to do so is to strive in the means of becoming the embodiment of all good qualities and through constant familiarity with the good heart to exhaust all faults. Uninterrupted familiarity with the noble path in past and future lives or reliance upon a profound method in this very lifetime is the means to sever the continuity of cyclic existence so cycle of birth and death need be experienced no more. So recognition of the two levels of truths. So the two truths are also explained in the non-Buddhist traditions. So what the two truths actually explain is that there is an appearance and a reality. So according to the non-Buddhist traditions, they explain that there is this appearance, the apparent truth, which, of course, on the basis of which the scientific explanations can be made. But we cannot suffice with the appearance, but in ultimately all the things are created by God. And then in Buddhism, we can talk about the two truths. Two truths. For example, if we take the example of a flower, the flower appears as a certain, in a certain fashion, and when we break the flower down into smaller parts, what we come to is finally a very, very subtle element or particle, like a wave. Light waves. And so we should not suffice with the appearance from the but we should also look at the reality from the scientific point of view. We can do like that. Now here we are going to explaining these two truths from the point of view of Prasangamadhyamaka point of view. To begin with, we must understand how two levels of truths are presented, how to practice the truth paths made of method and wisdom, and how, depending on them, the two resultant bodies are attained. Firstly, if we ask the system of the two levels of truth, how the system of two levels of truth is explained, the meeting Father and Mother Sutra says, and the knower of the world without listening to others taught only those two truths, these two truths. Whatever is conventional is likewise ultimate. There never exists a third truth. Similarly, Nagarjuna's text, Root Wisdom, also says doctrines taught by the Buddha are perfectly founded on the two truths. Objects of knowledge taken as the basic category can be divided into two classes, conventional ultimate truth. When an object is directly perceived as being ultimate truth, it ceases unequivocally to be conventional truth. The same also applies to the perception of conventional truth. And therefore, the two truths are mutually exclusive. If either of the two truths did not exist, all objects of knowledge could not be classified within them, yet there is no third truth, which is not one of these two. Thus, the very mode of classification into two truths does not allow for the possibility of third category. And so when we make classification of things, it may be done in order to dispel some misunderstandings and so forth, but with regard to two truths, it is to not allow for the possibility of third category. The two truths are distinct, nevertheless, if they are not one in nature, four absurd consequences would occur. That a form, form's lack of true existence would not be that form's mode of being. That although form's lack of true existence is realized, that realization does not overcome grasping at signs of its true existence. That it would be meaningless for a yogi to meditate on higher paths. And lastly, that even the Buddha has not burst the bonds of grasping at signs of true existence, and no abandon all the defilements which result in bad states of birth. If the true truths were one and indistinguishable, even in their isolates, these absurd consequences would ensue, as both actions and delusions, which are by nature conventional conceptions, were eliminated, the ultimate reality of phenomena would similarly be eliminated. Like conventional phenomena, ultimate reality would also have many different aspects. Even ordinary people would perceive ultimate reality directly, and while remaining an ordinary person, one would abandon all obscurations and become fully enlightened. Therefore, the true truths are one in nature, but distinct in their isolates. So, we have to understand the true truths also from the passage of Heart Sutra, where it says, form is empty, emptiness is form, form is not other emptiness, emptiness is also not other emptiness, form. So ultimate truth is the actual object found by reasoning consciousness analyzing ultimate reality. The mind which is involved with worldly terms and designations is called the conventional mind, or mind which is conventional. And the actual object found by it is the conventional truth. So in other words, the conventional truth is the truth or the reality which we perceive without doing any kind of analytical investigation into the things, just accepting what appears to the perceptions. And the ultimate truth is that which is found through by doing analytical or investigation into the nature of things. So in Sanskrit, the ultimate truth is called Paramat Satya. Paramat means, Parama means ultimate, excellent, etc. Artha means purpose or meaning. Satya means truth, permanent, etc. However, in this context, purpose does not denote the so-called purpose of self and others, but the object understood by an exalted wisdom awareness, the object of analysis, the object to be found. It is called ultimate because it is excellent, exalted, and bears such a significance. So unlike conventional fictions, whose mode of appearance is incongruent with their mode of existence, its mode of appearance is congruent with its mode of existence, therefore it is called truth or ultimate truth. If ultimate truth is further categorized, Acharya Chandrakirti says in his supplement to Nagarjuna's Treatise on the Middle Way, this selflessness was taught in two categories, that of persons, that of phenomena. In order to tell, liberate wandering beings, therefore the teacher further taught many aspects of it openly to the disciples, thus elaborating his taught the 16 emptinesses and privating them. Again, he taught four, which are also accepted by the Mahayana. So both selflessness of person and selflessness of phenomena may also be classified more elaborately as the four emptinesses, which are emptiness functional objects, emptiness functional objects, functionless objects, emptiness of nature of emptiness, and nature of, and emptiness of other entities, as the 16 emptiness, internal emptiness, etc. So when we talk about emptiness, of course, it has to be established on some object, something. Without there being an object onto which you establish emptiness, you cannot have emptiness standing alone as a standalone existence. And therefore, it must be related with something. And so emptiness itself is said to be empty of intrinsic existence. And in, when we establish the emptiness of emptiness, we have the first emptiness as the basis of the second one that is established on it. And And when those and all extend from in which shows not emptiness or known as conventional truth, when those are classified more elaborately, it is stated in which about the treasury of knowledge, heaps, stores of birth, classes are meant by aggregate sources and constituents. There are 5 aggregates, 12 sources, and extinct constituents. The 5 aggregates form, failing, discrimination. To form, this includes the 5 internal sense powers, having form, eyes, sense powers, etc., and the 5 external objects, form, sound, smell, taste, and tangible objects. These 10 with unrevealed forms and make up the 11-fold form aggregates. The feelings of pleasure and pain, neutrality, pleasure, pain, neutrality are the aggregates of feelings. The discrimination, conceptual and non-conceptual discriminations are the 2 components of the discrimination aggregates, each of which has 3 divisions, small, extensive, and immeasurable. Compositional factors, the aggregates of compositional factors includes both a collection of concomitant compositional factors, which include all the remaining secondary mental factors, feelings, and discrimination, and a collection of non-concomitant compositional factors, which are neither form nor consciousness. In consciousness, the aggregates of consciousness has since 6 components, from eye consciousness to mental consciousness. So with regard to consciousness, of course, there are various degrees of subtlety within consciousness according to Tantra. And then in Tantra, there are also mention of the 8 different consciousnesses, which must not be confused with the 8 different consciousnesses asserted by Chittamatra, the mind on this school. And so we have to be able to understand these consciousnesses according to the context. And there are 6 internal sources, eyes, sense power, and so forth. And there are 6 external sources, form, sound, and so forth. And form aggregates and form are synonymous, yet form source and form are not same. For the same source, for the form is only an object of eye consciousness, such as color and shape. Sound source and the object of ear consciousness are all synonymous, and the same is true of smell, taste, and tangible objects. So sometimes we say sem, yi, and nam shi are synonymous. But in Tantra, there are different categories of these 3 as well, which are differentiated. So these are the 16 constituents of sense power, which are supportive eye, etc. The 6 constituents of consciousness, which are dependent on eye consciousness, etc. And the 6 constituents of observable objects, form, sound, etc. In short, all composite phenomena are included in the 5 aggregates. All objects of knowledge are included in the 12 sources, as well as in the 18 constituents. Thus, all phenomena subsumed by the 2 truths are included in the 12 sources and the 18 constituents. So, chapter 2 finished. So we'll have a question and answer session now.
So he has two questions.
So he's saying that Tara, Saraswati, Vajrayogini are deities which also are found in non-Buddhist traditions, according to some scholars, many scholars.
Sometimes we also find mention of Takshiva, which is an epithet of Shiva. In our text, this Takshiva, or the eternally peaceful, is also sometimes a reference to Avalokiteshvara. So, as I usually say, there are practices such as yantras and the tumo practice of tumo, mystic heat, and so forth. They're also in this non-Buddhist traditions. And so the yoga practice is also there in the non-Buddhist traditions. But with regard to the deity itself, what is the nature or the identity of such deity that are found in Buddhism, when we talk about Saraswati, for example, the wisdom goddess, she's not up there, out there, as like a queen in her mandala or Manjushri. There's not some entity out there. And when once there was a lama who was giving teaching, and one disciple asked him, "Where is this Buddha?" And he didn't really understand Buddhism, and he just kept quiet for a while and then said, pointing his finger up in the space, he said, "Up there in the azure space, invisible space, there in a glass or crystal palace, the Buddha stands radiant there." And so we should not recognize the Saraswati and so forth as worldly deities, like we find many spirits or and with regard to Manjushri, we have all these praises. Manjushri being the son of the Buddhas or the source of the Buddhas and so forth. And so these come from Tantra. In Tantra, what is taught is how to take the resultant state in the path itself. And therefore, there is the practice of taking our emotions, such as attachment and anger, into the path. And you do not meditate yourself as a deity while still thinking yourself as a Buddhist monk. And so the deities appear to the disciples according to their mental predispositions, according to the power of the faith and the nature and interest of the disciples. The deities appear, the Buddhas appear, for example, in the form of different deities. So as you said, for example, Saraswati has her own mandala in which she sits or recites, and there is significance in meditating on Saraswati and her mandala within the context of Buddhist practice. And there may be many deities which are common to Buddhist and non-Buddhist traditions, but Saraswati should not be viewed as some kind of an entity out there without being related to the sentient beings. So, for example, from the point of view of Buddhism, we could say that the Buddha, Jesus Christ, was not an ordinary person.
It could be said that he was a manifestation of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. So it would be very difficult for a very ordinary, just an ordinary person, a very ordinary, a mundane person to have such an impact on this world and benefiting so many followers over the centuries. So with regard... So Tibetans have this prevalent belief in making offering of the incense and dharma, and also when someone breaks his or her leg, even then the person actually goes to some lama to do some divination and so forth. So how are these things? In relation to Buddhism. So as I said before, in Tibet, after Buddhism has spread in Tibet, of course, we have taken the certain elements of the Shengshung burn tradition, such as making offering of incense and also hooking in wealth and so forth. There are rituals to exorcisms. And so these... So because these practices were beneficial to a certain degree to... beings. These were also taken from the Burn traditions. And then we also have the practice of doing some ritual for wealth, making a wealth pot. And there is, in this practice, there is a head of an effigy of a sheep which is held in somebody's hand and then used in the ritual. So these are not Buddhist practices, but they may have...
Shendo Pecha Samayamba, Namjin, the Lomati to Gonda Nyakasu, Shendo Tonto and Lola and Jura Yuna and Sambudra and Jarum Bachichoni and Dusamatola Kalojin.
See, wishes that His Holiness gives some short praise that students can repine, recite while they go to bed. So. So merely reciting some prayers, if you were only to do some prayers, recitation of prayers, then the non-Buddhist traditions, the non-Buddhist practitioners have lots of prayers to say in Sanskrit. When you say prayers, the important thing is to reflect on the meaning of those prayers. So as soon as you wake up, in the morning, I remember this praise. I pay homage to the Gotama, who embraced or moved by his compassion, gave the teaching to dispel all distorted views. And so through these lines, I try to remember and reflect on the two principles of bodhicitta, compassion, and the view of emptiness. And I also recite this prayer, the two verses from Masanagarjuna's Mula Madhyamaka Karika, the verses of salutation, where it says, I pay homage to the Buddha, the best of the teachers, who has taught that anything that is dependent or originated is without arising, cessation, and so forth. And whatever is dependent or arisen is unceasing, unborn, not annihilated, impermanent, not coming, not going, without distinction, without identity, and free from conceptual constructions, and peaceful. So I try to reflect on the fact that there's nothing which exists independently through these verses. And then I set my motivation right in the morning to spend my day in such a way in accordance with the teaching of the Buddha. And then at the end of the day, before I go to bed, I reflect, I try to check whether I have actually reflect on these principles, whether I have actually done according to the intention of the Buddha or not. With just saying prayers, you can do it everywhere, even in the toilet, while so for self-cherishing attitudes to arise, there are two conditions that give rise to it. One is the grasping at an independently existing self, which serves as the basis, and reliance on which we have this self-cherishing attitude that arises. And therefore, when you see selflessness by gaining some understanding of emptiness, and through this, if you are able to develop some experience of inferential cognition of the selflessness, then it will serve to overcome this self-cherishing attitude. On the other hand, if there are people who may think of aspiring to reach liberation for themselves, as they are not able to think about helping all sentient beings across the space, expanse of space. And so there is also the self-cherishing attitude, which is non-afflictive. So this is not overcome through the meditation on selflessness, but through by developing the attitude which cherishes others more than oneself. So mainly what you have to understand is that all the negative emotions that we have come from self-cherishing attitude, and grasping at the self, and which in turn is rooted in the ignorance about the true nature of things. And therefore, when you understand emptiness, that will help to develop this compassion where you want to liberate other sentient beings. And that means developing altruism, and that in turn counters the self-cherishing and attitude. And mainly by thinking about the faults or shortcomings of self-cherishing attitude and the positive qualities of cherishing others. And so you have to see the pros and cons of cherishing self and cherishing others. And by cherishing others, you do not suffer. By cherishing others, you actually gain. So there is... now, how do you explain the combination of spirituality and temporal matters. So usually we have this idea of a lama taking over a spiritual master, taking over the temporal responsibility. And so with regard to the Dalai Lama institution being both the head of spirituality and temporal matters, this has now stopped. And the second understanding of the combination of spirituality and temporal matters is that you, in order to run a government and administration and so forth, if you should have moral basis, being honest and truthful and so forth. And so those who are responsible in people, and the people in authority who are responsible for government and so forth, they must have these moral principles, inculcate these moral principles within themselves. So for in the case of Tibet, after Tibet became fragmented, what actually binds all Tibetans together as one people and is Tibetan culture. So politically, for example, Amdo, the northeastern part of Tibet, in the past used to be under the Chinese jurisdiction, and then many of the Chinese, many of the Kham areas were also Chinese administration, and not under the Gurdon Portong administration. But then the Tibetans always felt themselves to be Tibetan and have this strong spirit of being Tibetan. And today, inside Tibet, this is very strong, this Tibetan spirit. They're not thinking or feeling grateful to the Gurdon Portong institution, Gurdon Portong administration, but because of the culture, and which has bound us together, and which has also benefit for individuals. And so, I always say this. In the West, religious institution, political institution must be separate. But then, administrators and would be much better if they have religious principles. These principles of honesty and truthfulness, and being more compassionate. So, on an individual level, we need both the principles of the mundane and spiritual principles. Whereas, when it comes to administrations, then they must be separate. So, the one person holding both the responsibility of spirituality and temporal matters is outdated. His question is related with vegetarianism. In Dharamsala, I came 2 days ago and here, and I found that most of the restaurants serve non-vegetarian foods. So I went to an Indian restaurant, and the owners asked me if I were not vegetarian or non-vegetarian. So So the Indians actually were quite amazed, and they told me that most of the Tibetans are non-veg. So we need to promote vegetarianism. It's very important. When I was 13 or 14 years of age, old, whereas in the past, all the Tibetan government official ceremonies and festivals used to serve non-vegetarian meals. At that time, I actually changed the diet and this and made it all vegetarian, changed it to vegetarian meals. And then in 1965, I became vegetarian for about 20 months from 1965 to 66. And then I suffered jaundice, and for about 2 weeks I was sick with jaundice, and my body, whole body became yellow and turned yellow, and even the nails. And then I consulted Tibetan, traditional Tibetan doctors and also allopathic doctors who advised me to return to my original diet. Told me that it would be better to go back to original diet. And so, after that, I have one or two times vegetarian, non-vegetarian meals in a week, one or two times. So I avoid those meals which are not allowed for monks by the Vinaya rules. And for the last 15 years or so, in the major monastic institutions, the common kitchens serve vegetarian meals. Of course, individuals are different. So what you said is right. Around those monastic institutions in South India, there are people who sell momos, non-veg momos. And so, because the common kitchen in these monasteries, monastic institutions serve vegetarian meal, many monks, actually these momo sellers actually do the, quite a good business by selling momos, non-veg momos. So sometimes when the meat is served, non-veg food is served in these monastic institutions for some feast, it was said that 10 cows or buffaloes had to be killed. And later this changed, and the monastic institutions became, I mean, they served common vegetarian meal from the common kitchen. And then in the West, the Dharma centers, I have advised to stick to vegetarian meals in the center, in the common kitchens, whereas individuals, when it comes to individuals, it's up to them. So, generally speaking, vegetarian meal is vegetarianism is very good. And then, within, if we look at how the animals are actually treated in the beef farm and piggery and poultry farms. So it's difficult to tell everyone to be vegetarian. So I have many friends who changed their diet to a vegetarian meal from non-veg meals, and then they became unhealthy. So I had a Chinese friend who was a vegetarian, and his health was very weak, and so I told him that your life is dedicated for the teaching of the Buddha and to serve others, and therefore you have to see the pros and cons of sticking to vegetarian meals or non-vegetarian meals. So of course, when you eat non-veg food, so if meat is not available, you should not ask for non-veg meal if it's not available in a restaurant. And so he listened to my advice and took some soup, non-veg meat soup, and it has helped his health. So when you have to take meat animal flesh, you should remember the whichever animal it is, and then you should feel grateful to the animal and say prayers for the animal. And so if you're so it's good to be vegetarian, but when you need meat sometimes due to health reasons, you should take them. So His Holiness earlier said that there are scientists who say that His Holiness said there are some scientists who are beginning to say that there is a mind which is separate from the brain. And I usually have this idea that scientists do not even believe or they even accept a mind or consciousness. But in Buddhism we have designations, presentation of the subtle and gross mind. So how do scientists believe or accept this kind of this gross level of mind if they do so accept? So in 1979, I was in Moscow somewhere and met some Russian scientists. So there was a very famous Russian scientist who did some experiment on with dogs using bells. When the dog is fed, he rings a bell, and then the dog actually gets the food. And afterwards, he rang the bell, but then he didn't feed the dog. But then, because the dog hears the bell, it actually had a three mouth. And so then I talked about sixth mind, mental consciousness, and he said, oh, this is something to do with religion and not science. And then one time I was in America, I had a conference with the scientists, and there was a lady, a scientist, who was told to me as being very famous. I don't remember her name, but she had this expression on her look on her face, which indicated that what do we as scientists have to have anything to discuss with this person who is a religious person, and with reference to me. Mm-hmm. And then in our discussion, we came across the topic of Creator God, and I said Buddhism does not believe in such a Creator God, and then also that there is no separate independent self. And then she became intrigued and said, oh, this is a Buddhism is something different, a different religion, she said. And then she began to take more interest in what Buddhism has to say about different topics. And the Geshe Thubten Jinpa was there as the interpreter at the conference. And so she went to Thubten Jinpa during tea breaks and asked many questions. What does Buddhism have to say about this? And what does Buddhism has to say about that? And so forth. And so, in the classical science, there's believed that there's no mind which is separate from the brain. Now, later, as I said earlier, by training the mind, there is people have seen that mind actually impacts the brain, and by giving training of mind. And the scientists have found that they actually impact the people's body as well, like lowering the stress level and blood pressure level and so forth. So one scientist in South India recently in January during a Mind and Life conference has said that he was not a religious person as such, but he believes in a past and future lives. In Portland also, we had a meeting. Jose Red. Jose Cabazon. Jose Cabazon, a professor at the University of, I think, Berkeley in Santa Barbara, told me that in Europe and in the West, there's 1% Buddhist, but 25% people in the West believe in past and future lives. So, of course, the people's views are changing these days, even among scientists. So, in when they talk about science, they have this idea of somebody observing some object as a third person, and then when they have some consensus amongst different people of the same object, then they so when it comes to subjective experiences, it cannot be taken as a scientific field of research, and it's very difficult to tell for them. And so most of the science so far have limited themselves to do some measurements and using tools to observe things, whereas mind is something which is totally different field of research. The instruments and the measurements that they use for doing research and experiment on material things cannot be used to look at the mind. So even with regard to time, the scientists are doing lots of research, investigating about some. Some say that time is absolute, others say time is relative. So when it comes to talking about time, it's not some kind of a matter there, or nor is it a consciousness. But we have to explain time in relation to something else. So there is all kinds of experiments done and explanations. So today, within the scientific field, of research and experiments, this field of experiment and research is expanding. So I usually say that the field of science, scientific research, is will increase, and therefore there will be more profound knowledge of the inner world of mind, and then the science would be more holistic. So far, science is not holistic because of not taking into account these subjective experiences as a field of research. So, of course, the scientists themselves have feelings and pains and pleasure and so forth. So this is some kind of experience internal to someone. And so it's not cannot be explained just by watching others. So this is going to be the last question. So there are lots of believers, whereas there are others who do not have any belief in religion. What is the best means to bring about peace of mind and harmony in the world? So I said earlier, secular ethics is the means. Even non-believers have pain and pleasure of mind. So people have neglected these, what's going on in the mind. So many people who claim to be religious go to churches and temples and do prayers, but outside temples and churches, the religion does not become relevant to them because they are not really sincere. They do not have sincere conviction of their religion, and therefore how many corrupt people we find amongst religious who do who are dishonest, deceive others, bully others, and exploit others. So in the name of religion, they do all these things. So what this shows is that they do not really have, they are not serious belief in their religion. So if a religious practitioner, unless a religious practitioner has a deep conviction in the practice of their religion and are serious about it, then they will not be serious about their religion. They may talk about love, compassion, and helping others and so forth, altruism and so forth, but then if they are deep in their heart, they only think about their own well-being, with their own welfare, full of selfishness. So that's how someone becomes hypocrisy. So if you are not serious about your religion, then religion actually teaches you to hypocrisy. So you have to see, you have to feel convinced about the benefits of the religion. So it's not only enough to say that, there's such and such Lama I believe in, but there are Lamas. Since there are some Lamas amongst Tibetans who seem to be actually breeding hostility amongst people. So recently there was a letter that the religion department of the CTA received from some people who say that there is one Lama who does all kinds of negative things. So while having the name or title of a Lama or a Tulku, if you actually exploit these names and abuse others and exploit them, it's not good. When I first visited Mongolia in 1979, I saw one an exhibition in a museum. There was a painting of a monk with hugely opened mouth, and in that mouth are people are entering into the mouth, and so the person who was actually describing me the paintings and so forth in the museum became a little bit embarrassed when it came to that portrait. So you have to have sincere belief in one's religion. You have to have real conviction in the teachings. So we don't need to talk about religion as such. If you are full of hatred and greed and so forth, how can you be happy? And so if you look at the world today, the leaders are killing so many people, and the whole world is actually despising them, whereas so these tyrants would actually, their names would be left in history, and people would say, oh, this such and such person was a tyrant in the past. And then in Burma recently, I do not know the real situation, but then there in newspapers there's reports about Buddhist monks destroying the Muslim mosques and beating up Muslims. So I have said that I have pleaded that these Buddhist monks, when they meet with such tragedy, they should remember the face of the Buddha, the image of the Buddha. So while wearing the Buddhist monk's robes, if they are overcome with the anger and hatred and greed, what is use? So if the Buddha were to come into their community, they would actually, I have said that the Buddha would actually protect those Muslims. So I have pleaded the Buddhist monks to see the image of the Buddha's face. So for whether you are a believer or non-believer, this secular ethics is very important for all.
Chidar kemba to kundu sambote te da kun ge che so ta lo chin ge wa ti da tham che rab do tu sum shi pe ge wa tham ji mo wa khan la cho da gi ge we tsa wa ti gu in ge sambo chi chi rab do mo wa ra ki
Dessa tende in ogni ciò, sono un po' ci sono delle cose.